Welcome to Uber Dad. This is episode number 6. That song is called Now's the Time, and it's by a band called My Insane Friends. And you're hearing it exclusively on the Uber Dad program. You want to hear the song in its entirety? I'll play it for you right at the end of this interview. All right, let's get to it. Music and acting. Imagine having a career where you could do both of those things. Our guest today has had some great success in both those realms, and we'll get to that interview in just a minute. But first, let's talk about music. I've always loved music. I mean, specifically guitar-oriented, heavier music, hard rock, even some metal. Bands like Kiss, Van Halen, AC/DC, Rush, Def Leppard. Okay, maybe a little Metallica, although quite honestly, I just like their t-shirts. I fell in love with the sound of rock guitar in the early 70s, and I wouldn't rest until I learned how to play all my favorite riffs. I would practice for hours and hours, lifting the record needle, putting it back, playing it over and over again till I got it right. I got pretty good, and maybe I'll prove that to you in another episode and play you some of my biggest hits. I don't want to brag, but the rumors are true. I did play my school library. I know. We all probably need a moment after that. Anyway, my first performance was at a middle school in Brampton, and after the show, they had to lock us in the principal's office to clear the school. The rabid fans had gone crazy. They were screaming for autographs. They'd stolen my shoelaces and guitar picks. It was a very Beatle-esque moment. Anyway, so you could see why I got hooked on the idea of being a rock star. I mean, it was pretty amazing. I played in lots of bands through my teens and into my 20s. I did the bar circuit in southern Ontario, into Quebec, a little bit down into the U.S., and one of the bands I played in still plays to this day, and they are one of the top AC/DC tribute bands in Canada. They get to play large festivals, big stages, even arenas. They get flown out to some shows. Figures. That all happened after I left. Probably sending me a message, I'm sure. Anyway, I'm happy for them because they're doing amazing. I was good enough, though, at the time that I got to play a lot of the same bars that many great bands that came out of Toronto played. Places like the Gasworks, Hot Rocks, which was actually in Brampton, the Opera House, and many others. A lot of great people got their start there. And when you play those circuits, you get to know people that are also other playing that circuit as well. So I'm very lucky to know a lot of amazing people, including guys like Phil X, who's now in Bon Jovi's band, Barry Stock from 3 Days Grace, Jason Hook, who played with Alice Cooper and is now in Five Finger Death Punch, and many others. I'm so proud to know those guys and so happy that they've achieved the success that they have because they absolutely deserve it. I quickly realized, though, that I wasn't cut out for this rock star life. So I began to use my design skills to work with the bands, and I would do logo design, posters, promo stuff, video work. And for the video stuff, I brought in my friend Todd Southgate, who worked at City TV at the time. He was one of the first City TV videographers, and he is an incredible director in his own right. And Todd's going to be on our next show, so you're going to want to stay tuned for that because he's an amazing guy and has been through stuff you can't even fathom. One of the bands that we did some work with was Slash Puppet. Todd and I were both really good friends with one of the guitar players in that band, which was Lou Garskadden. We went to high school with him and followed his career afterwards. And when he joined, we started helping them with whatever we could. Lou was born to be a rock star. And tragically, he died of a heart attack in 2001, which I still can't even fathom to this day. Slash Puppet was at the center of all the musical excitement, though, in Toronto in the late 80s and 90s. They were writing, recording, performing. They were buddies with Sebastian Bach and the guys from Skid Row. They got signed by Ray Daniels, who was the manager of Rush. They won the Best Club Act Award in the Toronto Music Awards. They were on Much Music with their video. Everything was happening for them, and it was an incredible thing to witness. I remember when my band rehearsed at the same facility as they did. We would just wander the halls and listen to all the bands, and we'd go in and hang out. I even got to play with the guys in Slash Puppet once using Lou's gear. The drummer, Franklin Wiles, and Pete Dove on bass, and here's me playing through Lou's stuff, and it sounded amazing. I just couldn't believe it, and I'll never forget that. Anyway, if you search YouTube for the song Slow Down by Slash Puppet, you'll see the video that Todd directed, shot, and edited. I was the executive producer, creative director, therapist, and the guy who had to constantly tell all the friends of the band to stop moving stuff on the damn set. That was the first video that Todd and I had done that ever that got played on Much Music, and which is Canada's MTV, as I'm sure most of you know. And so that was pretty cool, and we were very proud of that. And that song and that video still stand up today. The song's a great song. I love it. And the video's awesome. That era was just absolutely incredible. And it was an amazing moment in time. The music was great. I was surrounded by so many talented people. And you just could feel the energy and the excitement. And it was building towards something. But then something happened and things changed. And you'll hear that in the interview. Okay, let's get to the interview right now. On today's show, we have Anthony J. Mifsud. He goes by the nickname Miff. Miff has had an incredible career as a singer, songwriter, writer, and actor. He's got a wicked voice, a powerful villainous presence, and it makes him the perfect bad guy, which is really ironic because he's actually one of the nicest guys you will ever meet. If you watched the TV shows Aaron Stone, 12 Monkeys, or Hemlock Grove, you will recognize him immediately. His IMDb page is a mile long and continues to grow. Let's hear him tell you all about it. Let's cut to the interview right now. Miff, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Rick. It's great to reconnect with you, and it's great to be on your show.
Let's go back to the beginning. How did you make the leap from being a lead singer to becoming an actor?
Well, basically, I'd love to tell you that, I would wish to tell you that one platform kind of catapulted me into the other platform, and it did, but unfortunately, it was more of a negative scenario than a positive scenario, and what I mean by that is that we got to a place with Slash Puppet after 7 hard years. Well, actually, if you count the first 2 years tweaking members and rehearsing behind the scenes before our first show on Thursday, October 19th, 1989, I'll never forget that night at Rock and Roll Heaven.
I remember it well.
We had everybody behind us, including Drew Masters from Meat Magazine, who must always be heralded whenever you discuss Slash Puppet, because he had a terrific hand in helping us out, moving us along with Meat Magazine. As did Gareth Brown, the manager of Rock and Roll Heaven. These guys were two guys that were totally in our corner at the time, and big part. If there was to be a movie, hypothetically, these two characters would have to exist in the confines of that movie. But anyway, to get to the original question. Basically, what has happened is, we started rehearsing in 1987 with this project. We finally tweaked the members of the band. It started with a band called Frost out of the Jane Finch area, and Frost were friends of ours. In fact, when I was rehearsing at Safer Studios, which was the main rehearsal facility at Eddie Stone and Finch. Eddie Stone and Jane around the Jane Finch area, and all the bands knew one another. And there was everybody that was there, man. And from time to time, Platinum Blonde would come in. There was the guys from Anvil were there, Rob Reiner and Lou Garscadden, God rest his soul, friend of ours, my guitar player and Slash Puppet, were very, very good friends at the time. All the bands kind of that were revolving around that hard rock, heavy metal scene kind of revolved around that that Safer rehearsal studio. So everybody kind of knew everybody. And that lended to the tweaking of the band members. And we ended up with the lineup, the original classic lineup, if you want to call it that, which was myself, Franklin Wiles, who was the original drummer in Frost, along, and I want to mention their names because they are now performing in a band called Ugly Melon, and it's a very good band. And
they are awesome.
They're a phenomenally good, talented bunch of guys, and that consists of Lou Cacioppo, who also knows himself, goes by the name Lou Cacci, Tony LaSalva, the singer, who's, I've got a phenomenal story of a terrific longtime friend now, John Libertor, and Franklin Wiles. This was what was Frost. Basically, we tweaked the band from that grouping for, a variety of reasons, and ended up basically with myself, Franklin Wiles, being the original members. Then came along Lou Garscadden, then Pete Dove, and then Frank Bartoletti. Down the road, as if anybody knows about Slash Puppet history, Lou left the band, left the band. I don't want to condemn him in any way, shape, or form for so many reasons, but for the sake of argument, he left the band and was replaced by Marcel Lafleur from the band Madame X. At the time, people knew him from Madame X, I hope I'm getting that right. And then Dave Carrero came in when Pete departed, and it's actually the other way around. Pete departed first, just as we were doing the 1993 record with Anthony Vanderberg, producer. Pete had left, and then got replaced by Dave Carrero. We didn't miss a beat because Dave's a phenomenal bass player as well. And then we did the tour. things just started, and we get to what basically happened in the sense of the negative impact, and that was something totally destructive called grunge. So basically, the band worked its way up to 1991, where we, with the new members in tow, prior to the new members in tow, we got signed by SRO Management, who basically at the time handled bands like Van Halen, Queensryche, King's X, and the epitome of their office was Rush. And, Slash Puppet in 91 gets their big break. Shortly thereafter, Nirvana comes out with their record and Teen Spirit. And that was pretty much the catalyst that destroyed not just Slash Puppet's chances and opportunities, but all of hard rock and heavy metal's chances and opportunities at the time.
I remember there being talk of you guys opening for Van Halen on their tour at that time, which to me would have been the greatest thing ever.
Yeah, there was. There was always discussions. Once we got involved with Ray Daniels at SRO and the people there, things just started happening in two time, three time, four time. Everything just started going real fast. Unfortunately, it was kind of like a train wreck into a wall because of the whole grunge scenario. Had we met Ray, perhaps, in 1989, perhaps even 1990, I think potentially the fortunes of Slash Puppet may have been a little different. The one frustrating thing about being in that band at that time was how we kind of were the guys who, and I can say this wholeheartedly, broke down the barriers of these tribute bands at the time. I've got a phenomenal story with Gareth Brown and how when we first approached him, or perhaps Drew Masters may have approached him. Somebody approached him about our first show, and he insisted on at least one set of cover tunes, and we were like, no, we don't do that. So basically, we broke down the doors. We ultimately, it's a long-winded story, which if you want to get into later, we can, but basically we booked another show elsewhere. Gareth got upset, came to me and basically said, I don't get this. You guys, you belong here, but you've gone and booked there. I said, well, you made it contingent on us doing cover tunes, and we just don't do that. We just don't. And anyway, so far as I know, we've got, we were probably one of the earliest, if not the only unsigned band that actually booked their first show at Rock and Roll Heaven with all originals. And then fast forward to when we signed with Ray, we were most definitely the first band ever at Rock and Roll Heaven. And I mean ever, with capital letters, that did an all-ages show. First time ever. It was Slash Puppet.
Yeah. Those were amazing days. I had such high hopes for you guys.
Yeah, they were. They were terrific days. They were seven of the most amazing, arguably amazing and impactfully amazing. And I just, we went through a lot, as any rock band would know, regardless of to what length they go to have to get to where they got to get. And, as the members in Slash Puppet, for myself, I can speak completely for myself anyway. I'm very, very proud at what we were able to accomplish. I wish people would have taken us a little more seriously than they did now, because what I was trying to get at with that whole story about being the first to do just all original songs at the club without being signed to a major label, and then doing the full circle of doing the all ages show once we got signed SRO. Nobody. We had everybody sniffing around. Everybody loved the band, but nobody, for whatever reason, I can never tell you, and nobody signed the band. Everybody else came along after us. Sven Gally, Slick Toxic, I Mother Earth, all these bands came along, got signed. We did not, except for Ray signing us to a management deal, and then Ray trying his very best to get us an international deal, because Canada was sewn up, because automatically being part of SRO, we were going to be released on Anthem Records through either Sony or Universal. But nobody really took the plunge on us, and much of that had to do with the changing of the guard, as it were, musically, with the whole grunge thing coming out of Seattle. The most disappointing thing for me when people approach me about the band, or I see write-ups about the band, because, you know, in 2007 we re-released the demo and there was all this activity and people got on board with us. Anyway, the most frustrating thing for me to read or to hear is, wow, you guys were such a great band, man. You know, how did you not get signed? Well, I, till this very moment, I cannot understand or explain that. I just can't. I don't know what it was that we did so wrong that we weren't given a shot to try to endeavor further with that band.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's bizarre. But in my opinion, I don't think you guys did anything wrong at all. It was literally just the times and the tastes had changed and everything's a reaction against something else, right? But, you know, the past is the past. You've got a new band. And I saw a video that, my understanding, the video is recent, but the songs were written around 1995. Yet somehow the topics are still relevant to what's going on in the world right now.
Well, if you, and again, I'll bring you fast forward to the My Insane Friends video that I put out. And I wish I had a bigger budget. I pretty much directed all of it. My wife and I did most of the video work on that. Yeah, if you look at, there's two clips in there in particular where a character, a very ominous-looking futuristic soldier character, kind of turns and looks at the background. And there's a Russian element, and there's an American element. And bully for me that in 1995 I could actually write lyrics that would then spawn a video prior to the current administration in the United States and all that's going on with that, because it boggles my mind when I watch that now, because, you know, this was, like I said, this was long, not long, but at least a year, year and a half before before the election in the United States, the last presidential election. Yeah, and I'm not saying good, bad, I don't care. I just, when I look at the video, and like I said, I wish I had a little more money to have done that with just a little more oomph, but I'm proud of what I was able to accomplish on my own.
I think it looks great.
Yeah, well, it's you know, it was done as best as I could under the circumstances. I do, if there's one thing about the My Insane Friends video for Born Inside the Shell that I do like, is the conceptually, visually, conceptually, I was able to put across what I wanted to put across that I felt inside. And like I said, when you couple that with the fact that those songs were actually written in 1995 by myself, Michelle Scott at Delorme, Lionel Tissot on bass, Michelle being the guitar player, to basically be able to put forward visual aspects that now, to match the lyrics from 95 that somehow are still relevant, especially when you look at the particular clips that I just mentioned within the video, and with all that's going on, is pretty cool.
Tell us more about the My Insane Friends thing. This is your new musical project, right?
The whole thing with My Insane Friends was I started doing some work actually with a couple of extremely talented musicians. I mean, I'm going to say this because it falls within the confines of the question. I have had the luxury of befriending, recording with, performing with some of the most amazing Canadian talent in the hard rock, heavy metal music scene. First and foremost, I don't need to mention their names again, all the guys in Slash Puppet, exceptional musicians, all to their own. Lionel Tissot on bass, Michelle Scott at Delorme on guitar, Rick Smith on drums, Brent Nemi on drums, the first three being from bands like Hardway back in the day, Eiffel Power, that everybody must know, who knows anything about Slash Puppet or that era should know. And then you have, like I said, Brent, who came in to replace Rick in THD, because after Slash Puppet, the next band we had was Total Harmonic Distortion, or THD, with the aforementioned members. And Brent, you know, came from a band called Straight Jacket, which was also a phenomenal band back in the day. Went on to do some work with Brian Vollmer and Helix, live performances and some recording from what I understand. And I've got friends, you know, guys like Nick Walsh from Slick Toxic, all the boys from Svengali, you know, they were all friends of ours. And, you know, there was always a competitive edge, but the coolest thing about all the guys, there was no real like animosity. I mean, we were all willing to help one another if one another had needed some help. I really genuinely believe that. And like, you know, I think witness to that is the fact, for instance, that the guys from Ugly Melon are still some of the most amazing friends that I could ever ask for. Lou Cacci, Tony LaSalva, John Libertor, till this very day. If any one of those guys needs anything from me, I'm there, man. And I know I can probably say the same, you know, in the other direction. I'm still working with the likes of Michelle Scott at Alarm. You know, we did the video together. We released the music together. I've got so much material that he and I and Lionel Tissot wrote that we're you know, hopefully we'll be able to release at some point. You know, I don't want to forget anybody, but you know, then I worked not too long ago. I actually worked with KB Bradley from the band Big House, and we created some phenomenal music together. Not to mention a young kid that I called Jed. That is Jeff Wilson, who I actually had the luxury. These guys, anyway, were the last guys that I actually sat with and wrote songs and actually recorded songs with. And I got to tell you that there's a lot of material that's going to be coming out in the near future, I hope, that is exceptional with all those other musicians that I mentioned involved. But I think there's, for umpteen reasons, the stuff that I did with KB Bradley from Big House and with Jeff or Jed, Jeff Wilson, is stuff that I want to basically put out next, which brings me to your question about My Insane Friends. So when we first released the My Insane Friends six-song EP with Born Inside the Shell and the subsequent video, the concept was still, you know, the potential of putting a band out there, and had things maybe gone a little differently than they did, if something would have clicked, something would have caught on, somebody would have wanted to sign, we were prepared to go. Michelle and I were prepared to go. And I have no problem with moving forward with Michelle or whomever to that end. My Insane Friends now, I believe, is going to take on more of a conceptual premise rather than a band premise. What I mean by that is I have so much music that I want to put out. So much of it is so similar in strands, but very different in context and style. It would be impossible for me to release a record with a different name of a different band forever and ever and ever and have it, you know, somehow stick. So I think because I'm having a little difficulty with putting a project together for umpteen reasons, including an attempt at a Slash Puppet reunion that sounded phenomenal, by the way. Nobody knows this. You're the first one to hear this, Rick. We had a rehearsal. It sounded great, and shit hit the fan, and things went to pot for some reason or other, which I don't want to get into. But I can tell you, really, I was kind of caught in the middle of all of it. So unfortunately, that didn't move forward.
Oh, too bad. I would have loved that.
Yeah, it sounded great, man. It sounded great. I'm not going to get into it. I don't want to. You know, I do not want to delve on negativity. It's something I just don't want to do in my life anymore. Having said that, so My Insane Friends now will become a concept project rather than a band, in that My Insane Friends is going to be the name. You know, there will be a title for the next one, My Insane Friends. I have some ideas for what the title will be, and it may be the songs, you know, some of the songs that I wrote with Michelle and Lionel that have never been released. It may be some of the songs that I wrote with KB Bradley and Jeff Wilson with Jed. That, and by the way, Jed's in a band called Giants Walk right now, just in case. I want to make sure everybody gets a kudos. Anyway, I hope I'm explaining this correctly. The whole My Insane Friends thing, if you take the first initials of those three words, it's myth. And the gentleman who actually brought this to my attention was, in fact, Jeff Wilson from the Jed, and while we were doing what we were doing with KB Bradley. And again, I don't want to delve into any negativity, but it was left that, you know, we were trying to come up with band names, and this was brought to my attention. In fact, that the first incarnation was MIFF, My Insane Fucking Friends, which puts a fucking smile on my face. That was the first thing that was thrown at me by Jed. And then, you know, so basically we had a laugh over that, but it didn't progress for us at the time. But then a few years after that, I decided when I was going to release the Born Inside the Shell, Uncivilized, Dying Seed, which is probably going to be the next video, by the way, we'll get into that. But anyway, so I needed to come up with a name, and I thought, what the hell? I can't seem to get all the guys, you know, any members together to create a band for myself, so I'm just going to be the band myself. And without egotism, just for the sake of needing to have a title, it became My Insane Friends. And because I have been having trouble for several reasons, including, you know, my own schedule, which is a pain in the ass sometimes, because if I'm in the middle of rehearsals for something, I may need to drop it to go to film in Cape Town or Malta or whatever the hell I go to film. It's a bit of a burden. So anyway, in order to just keep the music coming out, for you're hearing this for the first time, it'll be conceptually every record for, moving forward will be My Insane Friends. And at the end of the day, if a band can be put together, then we have the luxury of playing all the different material from all the different guys that I've worked with. And each and every one of them I love dearly. I mean that sincerely. They have brought so much lessons, musical lessons is what I've gotten from these guys, whether they've been friends of mine like Nick Walsh, D. Carnell from Svengali, God rest his soul, you know, or the guys in the band Slash Puppet, or the guys from, you know, from THD and My Insane Friends. I've learned so much from these guys. I've matured so much because of them as friends and fellow musicians here in Toronto. I wish them all nothing but the best, including the guys in Ugly Melon.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing how much talent there is in this area. It's incredible. One of the great things about the My Insane Friends concept like this is that when you're ready to go out on tour, you might have your preferred guys and everything, but if they're not available for some reason, you have, as you just mentioned, so many other talented people to draw from so that you can still go out and play.
Yeah, I think that becomes, I mean, you know, it's scheduling, right? Like we've all, when you're like 20 plus years removed from what you were doing, and when, you know, basically in the, with the guys in Slash Puppet, I mean, it was a family, right? And, you know, within the confines of any family, you're going to have battles between members. You're going to have this, that, and the other thing between members, good things, bad things, little groupings over here versus little groupings over there. From time to time, all the groupings change. It's this myriad of you know, like a pot boiling, you know, making soup. You got all the ingredients and forever boiling, and something spits out, and then you got to put something else in. And anyway, it's very complicated at the best of times when you're actually all involved in something moving forward together. You know, you stop doing it, then 20 years removed, you know, you try to put it back together again. Now you're talking about everything that that needs to be taken into consideration within the confines of everybody's life, and it can be a little complicated, you know.
For sure. Have you guys ever gone out and played as the band Myth yet?
Ironically enough, shortly after we did THD, there was a lineup, and I'm glad you brought this up because there's another name that's going to pop up now. So the lineup was Michelle Scott at Alarm, myself on guitar, myself on vocal, John Pacheco on drums, another phenomenally talented drummer who's a very good friend of Brent Nemes, the drummer from THD and Straight Jacket, as well as Pete Dove. This was after Slash Puppet, and we put a couple of shows together, one in particular that I remember at...
Was that the one at the Big Bop?
Yeah. Yeah, I've got pictures to show it. I've got some promo shots that have never been released. And we did call it Myth. And I applaud the guys who I'd worked with in previous bands to come out and have no issue with calling it Myth. And we did. We did one show for sure. I think we did two or three anyway. One at Lee's Palace as well. And yeah, so we did. It wasn't My Insane Friends because nobody had mentioned the potential implication that way with those words, but it was Myth. And I got to be honest with you, forever I was trying, you know, if there's a little egotism in all this, there was always this, like, what can I, like, what mothers in Forge, you know, mamas for, or mamas in Flames, yeah, I would always try to come up with, but then Jeff Wilson, God bless his soul, came up with this whole My Insane Fucking Friends thing, and finally, there was this, this, like, you know, bulb that went up. And so yeah, we did perform as Myth with those guys.
I really think this is the perfect band concept platform for you.
Yeah, and that's, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'm leaving that. That's a very big chunk of what I'm trying to get at as well. Thank you, Rick. So, yeah, so it's kind of like my insane friends. Every one of those guys is kind of like my friend, for sure. I hope, you know, I hope they still are, right? I'm sure I've pissed one of them or all of them off at some point or another, but that's okay. You know, friends can do that. And, you know, from time to time, each and every one of them has shown me their darkest side, you know, so there's the insane element. So, yeah, I think it totally works. And this is why it is. And it's, I'll let you say it. Perfect. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like your music career is taking off, and it sounds like you've been incredibly busy with all of that. So where does the acting fit into all of this? And how did you get started doing that?
What I did was around the time of the EP that we were recording with Slash Puppet, I was already starting to delve into what they call looping. And at this point, I'm going to segue a bit. Some of the looping work that we did and also involved Pete Dove from Slash Puppet, from what I recollect, and another extremely important ingredient that was part of the Slash Puppet entourage, and that is photographer extraordinaire Ron Boudreau, right? So, you know, I got involved with doing some looping through a gentleman named Nelson Ferreira, Sound Dogs, who was the name of the company. We started doing voice looping for films, for Canon Film in particular, for Golem Globus. And we would do fight sequences. There were oohs and ahs and grunts and all that stuff. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? There's some times where I'd have to do some Arabic, so I would throw Maltese in there as the Arabic, which, you know. Anyway, but, you know, when I started getting involved with that, then, you know, Nelson knew Ron, knew Pete, and so from time to time, we'd get the guys in there, and we started doing this. All three of us started doing this, right? And then, you know, I'm forgetting, I think it was Michael Knox. I know Knox was for sure was his last name. He was the producer from LA who had heard through Nelson about Slash Puppet, and we were working together on a film called Doing Looping, as I mentioned, background voice work for a film called Chain of Command with Michael Dudikoff at the time, who was supposed to be the up-and-coming Chuck Norris. Anyway, they needed some songs for the end trailer, and they wanted to hear some songs to put into the film. Long story short, they loved When the Whip Comes Down. The video was just about to come out, directed by Sheldon Wilson. I want to drop every name that I have from my history, because without each and every one of these guys, the Slash Puppet wasn't just the five guys in the band, okay? I'm going to tell you that right now. Slash Puppet was all these other guys as well. Slash Puppet was Ron Boudreau. Slash Puppet was Drew Masters. Slash Puppet is still guys like Tim Henderson, Carl Begay from Brave Words. Without these guys, right, as part of a foundation, there's nothing a band's going to be able to do without any guys like this, okay? And these are dudes that actually were, whether they know it or not, whether they want to acknowledge it or not now in retrospect, I don't know, but were part of the fabric that became Slash Puppet, okay? Gareth Brown, as mentioned previously, you know, anyway, yourself, Rick, you know, you helped us, you helped me. Remember, you and I sat and worked on a logo together, if you recall. So, you know, everybody kind of pitched in, man. It was kind of like a community thing, yeah? That was the wonderful thing. That's what I was trying to get at earlier. There was this community vibe amongst the metalheads, because, you know, we were out there on our own, whether it was the guys in Slick, whether it was the guys in Sven, the guys in Varga, the guys in I Mother Earth, you know, some of them went on to do bigger and better things like your I Mother Earth. Slick did well, Sven did well. We were kind of left in the shadows, but that's okay. But at the time, when we were all striving, we were all struggling to get to where we need to get, there was this community vibe in Toronto, because we knew what we alluded to earlier. We knew that we were on our own as a community, as a metal, hard rock, heavy metal community. We were out there on our own, right? But anyway, bringing it back forward. So started doing the looping thing. I really started enjoying it. Then I started doing some extra work. I did about 2.5 years of that. And then a wonderful story involves David Carradine. I'm so sad that I have to continually say God rest his soul. But God rest his soul, David Carradine, on the set of Kung Fu, The Legend Continues. Okay, I was sitting there in between takes, and I was simply, you know, part of a group of extras, but I had my shaved head in. They needed punk rocker looking dudes. I had my nose ring in, stole the idea from Rachel Bolan from Skid Row, who are also were friends of ours, you know, Sebastian Bach. I mean, I gotta mention Bass, you know, this guy was the, the, the band leader that brought everything forward for everybody in Toronto, whether they know it or not. But anyway,
yep.
And then so I'm on the set of Kung Fu, The Legend Continues, and here's David Carradine kind of calling me over, and I'm like looking around, pulling the Joe Pesci thing, you know, you talking to me, right? Or sorry, the De Niro, you talking to me thing, right? I don't know why I always confuse that. I always confuse that, but it was De Niro from Taxi, I think, right? Anyway, so I go over, he's summoning me, and yes, it's me, and he's, you know, come on over here. So we have a conversation, and long story very short, within 3 weeks of that conversation, I am now on set doing my first speaking role, if not first, very early, on the same set, Kung Fu, The Legend Continues, ironically enough, as a bartender in a dream world called the Bardos. And people can look it up on IMDb. And I say ironically because while I've struggled over the years, I've had bartending as my mainstay.
Yeah.
But no, so that's basically how it came about. I basically got my first opportunity after a conversation with Dave Carradine and just kind of carried it from there. And it hasn't been easy by any stretch of the mind.
Yeah. What do you think it was that made him call you over?
Dude, he liked my look. I mean, I kind of looked like a young him from the original Kung Fu, right? That's what I chalk it up to anyway, because I remember when he called me over, he's like, you know, how you doing? What's your name? I'm like, you know, I'm Miff. He's like, hey, Miff, I got a son who's a marketing executive, he says to me, right? And if you saw my son, you wouldn't believe he's a marketing executive, right? He's got purple hair on one side, yellow hair on another side. He's got a ring just like that one in your nose, but I can't tell you where. You know, it was one of these. So he took a shine to my look, no ands, ifs, or buts, right? And anyway, to fast forward, so it's again, 6 degrees, right? So fast forward. So now I'm on set for Kung Fu, The Legend Continues, and we break for lunch. And as I'm walking to my trailer, because you know, even as an actor, you get a smaller trailer, but you get a little room, you get a little trailer. As I'm walking towards it, open the door for David Carradine's trailer pops open, and here's David, and he's a little happy. I'll leave it at that. And he's kind of like leaning, hanging over the steps that lead up to the trailer, and he's like, "Meth, great work, buddy." Like this, right? So I'm kind of like, whoa, now I'm buddies with David Carradine. Didn't take it too seriously because, you know, not to, but he was a great guy, man. He was a great guy. And then we had him when we, Slash Puppet, won the Toronto Music Award back in 1991, as did Baz, I think, for best lead vocal. Lee Aaron for best lead female vocal. And David Carradine presented one. I think he presented, if I'm not mistaken, I think he presented the award that Sebastian Bach won. I'm pretty sure he did. If not, perhaps Rush, but he did. He did present one of the awards.
That's pretty amazing. Pretty cool to have David Carradine as a coworker, huh?
Well, I wouldn't say a coworker, right? But I did have the luxury, thanks to David Carradine, the first speaking role or one of the earliest speaking roles, with, ironically, and believe it or not, and if people were to actually look up this episode, proof is definitely still there, with, if I might add, a co-starring credit, which is really freaking rare. And this is due to the producer of the show, the executive producer, Michael Sloan. And this bit of the story is a bit bittersweet for me, because once I did this Bardo's Bartender thing, they liked my work enough that, A, they did give me, because it was a two-part episode, by the way, they did give me a co-starring credit, like the earliest credit I have on Kung Fu, The Legend Continues. If you do go to the IMDb file, you're going to find that it's way down around like 96. So it's an early incarnation of my acting work. That was a co-starring credit. And that was the sweet bit. The bitter part about this is the fact that, I don't know if you remember a show called The Hitchhiker.
I do remember that.
Right.
Yeah.
I was brought in by the same Michael Sloan who must have liked enough what I did, besides giving me the co-starring credit on that, on those episodes of Kung Fu, The Legend Continues, brought me in for one of the lead roles. If not, again, my brain's a bit fuzzy. It could have been the lead role for The Hitchhiker. And I'm not going to get into the story of this, but I was still green. I had an aunt from Australia coming in that afternoon, and I was flustered at the audition. I remember him saying to me, "Meth, look, I know you can do this, but for whatever reason, you're a little, like, rattled. Why don't you go back outside?" I just couldn't get a grip on that. But things may have happened a lot faster for me, actually, had I been able to get that that audition done correctly. And till this very day, you know, I won't say I regret it because I'm still where I'm at. But it would have been a real big start to my career rather than the grind that it has been the last couple of years, not included perhaps, but it has been a bit of a grind. But had I maybe gotten that role and actually did something with it, actually gave Mr. Sloan what he saw in me a bit better in that audition, then maybe I would have been a little more forward, a little more faster, as it were.
Yeah. Well, that did sound like a pretty intimidating situation, and I'm sure around that time, you probably hadn't done that many auditions, but it's got to be a lot easier for you now, right?
Yeah, well, you get to a place where it becomes second nature, but the nerves, you know, I mean, even with the music, right? I remember, I'm not going to remember who exactly it was, but somebody had said to me early on in, when Slash Puppet started making some noise, and I mean that figuratively and literally. Basically, the mantra was that whenever you're preparing for a show, if you're side stage ready to come on as you're being introduced, if you ever lose that feeling, that butterfly feeling in your gut of nerves or excitement, or that's when you don't care anymore. So the reason I say this is because forever I have my agents telling me, yeah, go have fun, Myth. You know, enjoy the audition. Go have fun. Well, it's not fun. It really isn't when you're sitting at home studying lines, trying to assess the character, trying to put elements to the character, whether it be voice, accent, because I am getting a lot of roles where I'm able to utilize accents that I'm quite adapt to now. One being my first British accent on 12 Monkeys as Mr. Hockley. Yeah, so people look up those clips. And anyway, thanks to my English wife and her family around the table, I've been able to get the English accent in quite readily. Anyway, having said that, sorry, that may not be good enough because I haven't had time to prepare. Having said that, I just finished an audition just yesterday, in fact. Actually, I met with a director yesterday about a potential film in Malta, a fellow Maltese-Canadian actor turned director named Valerie Buhajar. I don't mind dropping names, man. This is all I'm about these days. And she is directing a film in Malta come, I think, December now. First was mentioned October. And she's renowned for Highway 61, one of the Bruce McDonald movies that came out, I think it was late 80s, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, so I had a conversation with her about potentially doing my first movie role in Malta, and I hope it comes to fruition. And I did audition for a new series, which I'm I cannot disclose right now, but it basically was a character named Lemaire, part French Arabic, I think, and I had to come in with kind of an international Arabic accent, which I hope I did well enough yesterday at the audition. It was actually what they call a self-tape. But anyway, so yeah, it's something you kind of fall into, but I take stuff so seriously, man, that sometimes I lose the fun element of it. And that's my bad. That is my bad, because it should be fun. But I just, you know, I don't take too many things seriously anymore, but when it comes to my work, I do take it seriously to the point where it becomes a bit of a stress. And if you saw my methods, and if you actually, recorded me on video and saw how I've got this one special place in my bedroom where I go with a particular light to really lose myself into the scripts, and then coming back and forth to sit and watch a little television just to clear my head, go back up, right? It would be like a comedic episodic show and on its own. But yeah, it can be a little stressful, although it should be fun. And I highly recommend anybody who gets into the acting thing when it comes to auditions and whatnot to bring as much element of fun to it as they can. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to, not the rest of my life.
Well, you know, if I go back to even the Slash Puppet stuff, everything that I've seen that you've done has been very, very professional. And you don't get to that level without, intensity and commitment and drive. You can't get there by winging it.
Thank you. I do appreciate that, Rick.
Yeah, I mean it. With all that intensity, though, are you able to enjoy it and kind of relax a little bit when you're, in the moment?
Well, Yeah. I mean, it's a bit burdenous for me, you know, in particular with, I mean, it was with the music too, right? Like, I mean, I was just, and you know, sometimes I know I recall being a little bit anal about certain things, the way it was recorded, you know, with the voice and whatnot. But I think if you just go in too happy-go-lucky, sometimes you're not going to get exactly what you want. And like, you know, everybody that knew me, I'm a little different now, but back then everybody that knew me knew that I thrived on two elements, intensity and stress, because you can't have one without the other, I don't think. Like when I have to go hit a fucking high note, perhaps not as high as bass, but if, you know, high enough, you know what I mean? I can do some Robbie Halford stuff. You know, when I go to do that, am I not really stressing my vocal cords to get up to that intensity? I think you are. And I think it's the same way when I study lines. And there are so many elements that I'm learning, still learning, forever learning. And maybe that's the reason why I have so much passion for the acting thing, because more so than the music even, there's this me forever learning. I'm forever learning. I watched, you know, I want to talk about a film called Lima, for instance, that I shot with Neil Blomkamp. God, can't leave this out. Neil Blomkamp, director of District 9, Elysium and Chappie, South African born, but raised in Vancouver, learned his craft as a phenomenal director. I think they call it CGI, if I'm not mistaken, computer wizard. Anyway, we did a film called Lima in Cape Town. I was lucky enough to get the role of a lieutenant colonel, and I'm going to leave it at that. And it involved Kellan Lutz from the Twilight series in the lead role, and an actor that not too many people may know of named Michael Rogers from Vancouver, now based in New York. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because, besides the fact that I worked with these phenomenal people, both Kellan and Michael were astoundingly amazing actors who, when I was struggling with this huge scene, I only had two, three scenes, but one of them in particular had so much dialogue, and it involved these physical elements that no matter what you do at home to study, you can't until you walk on set. You need time to kind of sort out, you know, looking at a computer, writing something, looking up at a screen, directing yourself to the actor in the scene. Anyway, I was struggling at first, and I had studied this thing for 4 weeks, right? Too long, sometimes, I think. When you study too much, sometimes it's too in your head. But anyway, and all it needed was a little tweak. Instead of looking up at the screen to talk about this criminal 8 times, I simply went to Mr. Blomkamp and said, look, because I was struggling, right? I was struggling to fit it into my dialogue. And I said to him, no, not 8, 2, okay? 2 times is all I'm going to do. And, you know, Michael and both Michael and Kellan came over and put their arms around me. And Kellan in particular said to me, we picked you for this role. We know you can do this. You are the lieutenant colonel here. And, you know, they were great about it. But the point I'm trying to make is that, yeah, until the camera's rolling, that is when there are two moments where I lose my stress and gain some contentment. A, when the camera starts rolling because you cannot show it, and B, when the camera stops rolling, and in this case, if I may herald myself after telling you how much I struggled in the takes that were the medium and long shots, when it came to my close-up, okay, and it was this, you know, I'm sitting at the end of a table with the camera at the end of the other side long, and the camera's pushing in on me as I'm doing this dialogue with Michael and Kellan at either side of the table, with me in the center. The minute they started rolling on my close-up, I nailed it in one take, okay? And both the guys, so, you know, Neil comes out, gives me the thumbs up, Kellan gets up and starts clapping. Fuck me! One fucking take on the close-up like this, right? That's an actor's actor. Because I was holding up production for a little while when I was struggling from the outset on this, right? And that's the second time where you finally lose your stress, when the director gives you the thumbs up. Okay, let's move on. That's the expression. Okay, got it. Let's move on. At that moment, yeah, cool. Nice. I can relax.
That's very cool. That's got to feel so good.
Yeah.
I would imagine, too, that doing things like that goes a long way to building your reputation amongst the directors and other actors and everything, too, which hopefully would lead to more roles, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's tough in the sense that, you know, going in that, you know, on movie sets, man, time is money and money is time, right? And I don't like fucking around, man. You know, I don't like screwing around. And In the last 2 years, I've got a new agent out of Vancouver, Nigel McCoskey. Nigel has been really, really cool in being able to get me some seriously cool roles. And he's endeavored to go outside of the box where people usually see me as just the criminal type guy, you know, the guy who's killing or being killed, as it were. And, you know, those roles still come along because I have that ugly mug that everybody loves to see as a criminal, right? But, you know, I've been able to do an amazing character on Hemlock Grove that goes from being a Greek delivery guy with the Greek accent like this, you know, and then becomes the actual Dr. Price on the show because Dr. Price's brain matter is put into my body, and I basically become him. So I had to go from this Greek, you know, Greek delivery guy to basically a Data-like character because that's what Dr. Price is in as far as the way I perceived it anyway, and I must have perceived it correctly because they, you know, they did like what I did for them. So yeah, you know, Data from Star Trek, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of, you know, it talks with it, you know, moving the head like a little bit of a, you know, androidish robotic. Yeah, and if you watch Hemlock Grove, you'll know what I mean by it. When you see Dr. Price, he's very much like that, the voice, the mannerisms, you know, and I had it down with him, you know. Delafuentes is his name, the actor. Anyway, there was one moment where I had to smell myself, and I couldn't understand why I had body odor because Dr. Price is so fucking spick, you know, spick and span clean, right?
Yeah.
And even when I did the smell thing, this is you know, a director will come to you and say, you've got it down, but that's not the way that Dr. Price would smell himself. Okay, this happened to me. So I looked at the Mr. Delafuente, and I said to him, I hope I'm getting it right once again. I hope I'm getting this right. I said to him, well, if you don't mind, can you show me how Dr. Price would do it? Like, this is in between takes. And he did. So the next take, boom, there you go. But, yeah, getting back to the point, Nigel has been able to get me, my Canadian agent has been able to get me some seriously cool characters that are outside of the box. As I mentioned, the English time traveler named Mr. Hockley, one of the four horsemen, as it were, on 12 Monkeys in the TV series season 3. This character, the Greek delivery guy, turned Dr. Price in Hemlock Grove. You know, and now I'm going out for a criminal element type guy, but a little different than what I'm accustomed to. I'd basically be the main danger element in Morocco. That's all I'm going to say because I really can't. I've signed a waiver that I can't discuss this. You know, so basically I'm the crime boss, but I'm based in Morocco. I'm going to say that. And hopefully I get this because I would love to travel to Morocco.
How cool would that be?
You know, you enjoy it while it's happening. Then you get on set and you stress a bit. You do what you got to do. Hopefully you don't drop the ball. You know, you don't get fired. You come home and they're saying nice things about you. Then you've got the luxury of waiting to see what the fucking critics think, because then that's another altogether different ballgame. So it doesn't matter if the production likes you. It doesn't matter if the executive producers like you. It doesn't matter if the director likes you or the fellow actors for that matter. Now you got to wait for the fucking critics to see if they like you. So it's not easy, man.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
I really hadn't thought of it from that perspective. But it's not like you haven't done this before, right? I mean, didn't you fly to Cape Town?
Yeah, I'm flying to fucking Cape Town, South Africa to shoot a fucking film with Neil Blomkamp. Yeah, that was exciting,
yeah,
man.
Exactly.
That was exciting. But I'll tell you something else. This is how much I love this this craft that I'm now involving myself in. More so than going to Morocco, because I just came back from a trip to Malta, where I hadn't been with the missus for 20 years, and I reacquainted with all my family, pretty much on my father's side. And I did put out a press release, not knowing if anybody would pay attention to it, but I did get some interviews while I was there. Having said that, the potential of going back to Malta and working on a film in my home country where I was born, not that Canada is in my home country, because I consider Malta and Canada both two sides and two parts of my heart.
Are you fluent in Maltese?
Yes, I am. And both interviews that I did on the radio were done in Maltese, and for several reasons. There were also two TV interviews that were supposed to happen, but because of time restraints and the hosts not being in Malta while I was in Malta, we're going to defer that to the next time I get there. Like I said, I'm hoping to get there on this this film. Again, I'm not at liberty to discuss any particular details, but the point I'm trying to make is that, yeah, you know, we're traveling first class to do a picture with Neil Blomkamp from Toronto to South Africa is something like, you know, just, it's mind-boggling still when I think about it. But if I have to travel economy, okay, to do do a film in Malta and live with my aunt, Jusa, who I lived with for the 17 days that I was there, with my wife being part of the last week that we were there, in order to be able to allow the production to afford to have me. Yeah, I'm still doing it, and I'm still going to be as stoked as it was, because, you know, it's not about how you get there, man. It's getting there and getting on the set and doing what you got to do.
Mm-hmm. Have you got any TV or movie things coming up that we can see?
No, what I've got is the trailer for Lima came out around Christmas time, and it's the flagship episodic project that Neil Blomkamp, Mr. Blomkamp, produced for their new production facility called Oats Studios, and that is Oats as in the meal, oatmeal, as it were, but it's Oats Studios, and you can go on to Oats Studio. They've got a webpage, Facebook, YouTube, and you can see all the projects that they've involved themselves with. One included Sigourney Weaver, one included Dakota Fanning, and then basically there's a few of them. The one that hasn't yet come out, which is supposed to be, like I said, the flagship episode or film, is the one that I was involved with called Lima. And I hope it comes out, because you know what, man? Kellan Lutz isn't just a gorgeous guy. He's actually a very good actor and serious, very serious actor, too. And I nothing but kudos. And just as good as Michael Rogers. There's even one moment when I watched the trailer, because I was about to say the trailer's out for it, but the film hasn't been released yet, and I'm chomping at the bit for it to be released for several reasons. This is my first, like, totally real cool, not the first military guy I've ever played, but the first really full of dialogue kind of military guy that I've ever played. And Michael Rogers, there's one moment. There were many moments with Kellan and Michael, but there's one moment in the trailer in my scene, because there is a clip of my voice. There is my voice in the trailer and a clip of the scene that I'm involved with, the big one, where, upon playing the trailer, I just noticed something that Michael does that is so fucking simple, yet so amazing of him to even think about doing. And I don't want to get into that, but I hope it comes out, man. And I hope it comes out soon, because the guys are great. And I know Neil's work is phenomenal. So can't wait for that to come out. And like I said, I just finished a self-tape for this I can't call him a mob guy, because everybody's going to think Pesci, De Niro, but it's not. It's he's a high stakes upper echelon criminal who controls artifacts and whatnot throughout the Moroccan region, European.
That sounds
European.
Really cool.
Yeah, I did a self tape for that, and hoping, keeping my fingers crossed, and it's more. Looking more so like potentially a film in Malta sometime in either December or January as well, with a cool role where I might be able to speak both Maltese and English.
Wow. That role sounds like it was totally made for you. What an amazing experience that would be.
Yeah, it would. It really would. That one, even though with that one, like I mentioned earlier, I mean, because it's funded the way it's going to be funded and produced the way it's going to be produced, I would even swim to fucking Malta to do this role, is what I'm trying to get at. Yeah.
Well, that might work out as part of the preparation for the role.
It could help my fucking lungs and my heart rate, too. Or pop both, I don't know. But anyway, yeah, so there's forever stuff on the horizon, and, this isn't something I'm going to walk away from now when people ask me about it. I'm still not exactly where I would like to be with all this, and I don't mean, fucking millionaire, bazillionaire actor guy, if I can get to where Dwayne Johnson is, The Rock is, God bless him. I would love it. But it's not all about the money. It's about what I love doing. It's about what satisfaction I get from doing what I love doing. And if I can get away from having to do anything else, and anything else could be anything from writing, writing stories as a freelance writer to managing bistros on a part-time basis, which I'm currently doing right now. And, I enjoy it. I don't love it, but I do enjoy it. If I can just hone in on, potentially music, but more importantly, acting as the primary go-to gig that allows me to not have to worry about anything else, then I know I've arrived for me. I always said it before I had any success whatsoever, and I'm not sure you can call what I have right now success. Some people think it is. If I could be that guy that you say, that bald guy, man, I can't think of his name right now, but the bald guy, the Maltese guy, that guy, right? If that can happen, I'll be satisfied.
Dude, I think you're already there. Everybody I know, they recognize you. They recognize you from a lot of the different roles that you've played. So, but you know what? I know what you mean. And I know you're going to get there. Not a doubt. And you know what? I think it's really cool that you've remembered all the people along the way that have kind of helped you get where you got to. So many times people kind of make it, they get successful like that, and then they kind of leave everybody behind. You hear it a million times, right? But you haven't done that, and I think that's really super cool.
Well, this is what I want to say, because, right now I'm thinking about a gentleman named Archie Hatchie, who I think Jim Torres, guys that, when I said the bit earlier about the foundation, the fabric of what is Slash Puppet, I hope I haven't forgotten any guys. Steve Saint, huge, helped us out in ways that I can't explain. Anybody, all of the friends that we had that came out to the band, the performances religiously. Anybody and everybody that I've ever been touched by in any way, shape, or form, and hopefully I touch them back in... that could be a loaded phrase, but you know what I'm trying to say. Anybody who was was there for the guys in the band and has been there since that, and has been able to be part of this amazing journey that I seem to be on now, and I hope to God can continue to do into the future, including yourself, Rick. Anybody in to whatever capacity, I want to thank and thank them sincerely for bringing something in the way of an education, perhaps, or something in the way of a smile, or even something in the way of a stress that led to something good. I want to thank them all very much from the bottom of my heart.
Awesome. Well, listen, I want to wrap up by playing one of your songs, but just before we do that, is there anybody else that you want to mention, just because I know that you don't want to leave anybody out?
Everybody and anybody, man. I know I'm forgetting names, and I'm just going to ring off a bunch of names here, if you don't mind, Rick, because, like you say, I don't want anybody left out that had a big hand in this, and there are so many people that I still need to mention, the likes of Todd Southgate, who helped us with the direction and the production of the first Slowdown video for Slash Puppet, which was immeasurable in weight and importance. Paul Frustaglio, who was helped us out with the production of the 1993 record, not to mention managerial elements that he got involved with at the time. Steve Frustaglio, who at times was actually the sixth member in Slash Puppet. Apparently, we had a keyboard player that never played keyboards with us, named Steve Frustaglio. Steve Fitzpatrick, longtime friend and huge, huge help for me in particular throughout those years. Fast forward to guys like Rick Hazelwood, and my brother and all of the guys from the Junction, the Junction Boys. We actually had a title for them. I want to thank each and every one of these guys, man, and everybody and anybody that had anything to do with, again, I repeat myself, thank you so very much for all of your input. Thank you so very much for everything you brought to the 7 years that was Slash Puppet and beyond that. From the bottom of my heart, thank you all very, very, very much.
Awesome. Okay, now let's get to the song. And this is a little bit of an exclusive, I believe, right?
Yeah, that's right, Rick. Actually, this is a song that actually is going to hopefully be off the next release for My Insane Friends, as we discussed. This was a song written with KB Bradley, formerly of BMG, recording artist, Big House, guitar player extraordinaire, man. This guy's a guitar player, producer dude, and we were able to do this together a few years back, and I'm hoping to do, as we mentioned, or I mentioned, one more video for the last six song EP from My Insane Friends, and once we're wrap that, if there's going to be another release, which I'm hoping will be soon enough, it will involve or include this song, which is called Now's the Time, and it goes something like this.
Yesterday, weighing on my
That song is called Now's the Time by My Insane Friends. And at the moment, this is the only place you can hear that because it's Miff gave us an exclusive on that. And I thank him very much for that. I love that song and I keep playing it over and over and over again. If you'd like to hear more My Insane Friends, they're available on all the major streaming platforms, including CD Baby, Apple Music, Spotify, Pandora, and Amazon. Go and download it right now. That's a wrap for this episode. Remember to subscribe, follow, or favorite Uber Dad on your favorite podcasting app. Those include Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and iHeartRadio. And check out the new and improved Uber Dad website, www.uberdadshow.com. Make sure to sign up for our emails while you're there. This episode is one of the first ones where I've actually sent out an email announcing that the episode is live, and I'm planning on doing that from now on. Lastly, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at UberDad Show on each of those platforms. On Facebook, we have an exclusive VIP UberDad group, and just request access and I'll let you in. That's where I keep all of my deepest, darkest secrets. Thanks for listening. Now's the Time, used with permission. Music by KB Bradley and lyrics by Anthony J. Mifsud. Miff Entertainment Canada, copyright 2008 to present. All rights reserved. UberDad is written, recorded, and hosted by Rick Brown.